Welcome to the Deadcast.
These men are members of a paedophile gang who tortured and killed a young boy. Most will soon be out of prison. Sidney Cook was the leader of the gang, yet he's already a free man, and already has plans for the gang to meet again.
They are killers, and they kill for sexual pleasure. It's as simple as that.
Cook was jailed so that children would be protected from him. Now he's at liberty. How safe are they?
Hello and welcome to our dispatches update. I'm here with officers from forces from the south of England. Detectives and counsellors have been taking calls ever since 3 hours ago. Dispatches presented evidence that police believe links Sidney Cook to child sex murders and appealed for new evidence about his activities. There's been an overwhelming response. Usually the police use television to appeal for information to help them find the perpetrator of a crime. But in this case, the police make no secret of their prime suspect. Earlier this evening, dispatches chronicled the disturbing story of Sidney Cook and the paedophile gang he led.
Cook is already one of Britain's most notorious killers. He and his gang took 14-year-old Jason Swift to this flat on East London's Kingsmead estate. Jason died in an orgy of sexual violence. Cook's police confession was witnessed by a retired Salvation Army officer.
In 73 plus years, I would say he was the most evil man I've ever met.
Hello and welcome once again to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me this week as we look at another true crime case. Before we dive into that, however, if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter at Author Totten. I am also on Instagram at Ian Totten Author and Facebook at Ian Totten Author, where there is a Deathcast group linked to my author page. If you'd like to help support the production of the show, you can find me on both PayPal and Venmo at Ian Totten. I also have a Patreon page at Ian Totten Author. There's a couple of tiers already up there, and I'm working on making another tier for patrons where I would release exclusive content. I'm going to give our book of the week now before I forget to do it at the end of the episode. And this one is called The Warrior's Pilgrimage, The Adventures of Remus, Book 1 by Frank Schildiner. And that can be found on Amazon. This week's book, I haven't read it, but I do know Frank fairly well. And he is donating all profits of this book to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Again, that's The Warrior's Pilgrimage, The Adventures of Remus, Book 1. It's more likely than not a pulp book like they used to put out in the 30s and 40s, like The Shadow, the old Robert E. Howard Conan books. So if you're into that kind of thing and you want to help support a good cause, you can find it on Amazon. Again, the book is The Warrior's Pilgrimage, The Adventures of Remus, Book 1 by Frank Schildiner. Like I said, he's a good guy. Now that the plugs are out of the way, before I even do my normal spiel, I want to give a warning. There is going to be some pretty heavy subjects discussed in this week's episode, as I'm of course covering the man known as Britain's most notorious pedophile, Hissing Sidney Cook. He did some pretty horrific crimes, which I'm gonna be covering in some detail. So if this is the kind of thing that sets you off, just turn off the episode now and go listen to something else. That being said, get yourself something to drink, sit back in your chair, relax, close your eyes, I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Okay, as you heard in the trailer, those were just a couple of reports from British television on this week's subject. Sidney Cook, also known as Hissing Sid, he is the archetype boogeyman of pedophiles. He's also a convicted murderer. He's a suspected serial killer, in fact, which is why I am covering him this week. Sidney Cook, there's really nothing redeemable about this man. In fact, you know, you hear the conspiracy theories about, you know, child pedophile rings and things of that nature, and how the entertainment industry and the government is linked to them. That's Sidney Cook. He is the real deal. There is verifiable evidence that police have released linking him to all of these things. Unfortunately, police did not know of Cook's existence until it was far too late. Sidney Charles Cook was born April 18th, 1927 in Stroud, Gloucestershire, England. And I found it kind of hard to track down his early years. I know that he came from something of an impoverished background, and he spent his formative years working as a farm worker. And subsequent years, Cook later went on to say that he could link his crimes directly to the abuse that he suffered at the hands of the adults in his life as a child. However, this has never been able to be verified, and if it has been, then the British police forces have not released this information. At any rate, Cook left working as a farmhand at some point in the 1960s and hooked up with a number of traveling carnivals, or as they call them in Britain, fun fairs, where he would operate a children's version of the Test Your Strength game, his game involving using a hammer and a bell. And it was through this job, which allowed him to travel around the country at will, Cook came into contact with the majority of his victims. And I want to point out that some of the information out there on Cook is speculation. Again, he is one of those criminals who does not like to talk about the crimes for which he has been convicted or which he committed. What is known is that by the 1970s, Cook had linked up with a number of other pedophiles, and they began using what the British term as rent boys, which are really just homosexual prostitutes. Unfortunately, in the case of Sidney Cook and his friends, the prostitutes that they favored were generally prostituted against their will. As in Britain, there has been a very strong, lucrative child sex trafficking pandemic. Something that makes the news on occasion only to be forgotten about and pushed to the side until something else new comes out. It really got headlines, I think it was 2011 or 2012, when former BBC personality Sir Jimmy Savile died and hundreds of allegations came out, and it was speculated that he may have been linked to Cook's gang. Now, what this gang would do is they would entice kids to come up to their flat in London, where boys would be drugged, following which each member would pay $5 and they would take turns raping the children. And this would generally not be a one-time affair. This would go on for a number of years, and oftentimes Cook and his cohorts would grow tired of the boys and then sell them to other pedophiles and other pedophile rings for their own use and enjoyment. And police have characterized the boys that Cook and his friends targeted as being nothing more than meat for these men. First disappearance and murder that has definitively been linked to Cook and his gang, which were dubbed by the British press as the Dirty Dozen, took place on June 1st, 1984, when 7-year-old Mark Tilsley went to a fun fair in his hometown of Workingham. Again, remember, for my American listeners, a fun fair is just basically a carnival. Now, Tilsley had a relative amount of freedom, as his parents and those who lived in the community considered the area safe for children, and it was not unheard of for children of Mark's age to be allowed to go to things such as fairs or the candy store unattended by their parents. So on the afternoon of June 1st, 1984, Tilsley met a man outside of the candy shop, which was located on Denmark Street. And the man apparently gave him a 50-pound coin to buy some sweets with. And this is known as the person who worked inside the store recognized Mark and said he often came in with a 10-pound coin or 10 pence. I'm not sure of the British monetary system. At any rate, he went into the shop and apparently the shopkeep asked him, you know, where he got the money from, and Mark informed her that the man outside had given it to him to buy some sweets with, and that the man said he was going to the fair later that evening, and that if Mark came to the fair, he would pay for him to go on the bumper cars. At around 5:30, just after dinner time, Mark left his home at number 1 Rose Court off of Rose Street, riding a gold Rally Tomahawk bike to make the half-a-mile journey to the fair. According to his parents, he said, "Don't worry, Mom, I won't be late," which his parents took to mean that he would be home by 7:30. Tilsley met up with a couple of his friends on the way to the fair, who wanted to go home first before going to the fair, so Mark decided to go on without them. And this is the last time that Mark Tilsley was seen alive. At 7:30, when he had not returned home, his parents became concerned, and at 8 p.m. they went down to the fair to see if they could find him. Unfortunately, the only piece of Mark that they could find was his gold bicycle, which had been chained to railings near the entrance of Carnival Field. His parents spent an hour looking for their son at the fair before returning home with his bike. When they arrived home, they found their older son, Christopher, watching television, but no sign of Mark. At 10 p.m., Lavinia Tinsley phoned the local police to report her son missing and apparently asked if they had heard anything, although she was told to phone back in an hour. In the meantime, Mark's mother called her oldest child, which was her daughter, as well as her daughter's husband, and the entire family went back to Carnival Field to search for the child. Now, this was a pretty big missing persons case in Britain at the time, such that the Thames Valley Police recruited the army to help looking for Mark. They also brought in a helicopter to scan the surrounding areas to see if they could possibly find, you know, any evidence of Mark. You know, maybe he had got wandered off in the woods and gotten hurt and couldn't get back. They did not know at the time what had possibly happened. Police also spoke to all the carnival workers, as well as canvassing the entire town and the 960 buildings which were in the town. The case became so big that it was mentioned on the British television series Crime Watch UK. I gather it was similar to Unsolved Mysteries here in the U.S., where they would try and elicit information in regards to unsolved crimes, and this resulted in over 400 calls and tips being put into the police station. The result of all this was a major tip in that people called in reporting that they had seen a child that matched Mark's description being dragged away against his will from the fair between 7 and 8 p.m. by what was described as a stooping man. There were further sightings of Mark and this stooping man on side streets in town, as well as other reports coming in from different areas of the country stating that Mark had been seen riding on various buses and in taxi cabs and walking down streets, although none of these could ever be confirmed. But for the most part, the case appears to have gone cold. Almost a year later, a 14-year-old boy named Jason Swift went missing. Now, Swift's family has been described as loving, although it has been said that Jason kinda did his own thing, oftentimes leaving home without telling his parents of where he was going, only informing them of his whereabouts by sending them postcards. They became concerned in July of 1985 when the cards stopped arriving. His body was found later that year in November. It was buried in a farm in Ongar in Essex by somebody that was walking their dog, and it was evident to the police that the boy had been sexually assaulted as he was naked, and they also found blood inside of the grave. Now, the police didn't have any suspects at this point, but a week after Jason Swift's body was found, another body was found. This was a 6-year-old boy named Barry Lewis who had disappeared from South London after being taken on the 15th of September. He too had been horrifically sexually abused before being killed. One thing that police noted was that the same tranquilizers were in the boys' bodies at the time of death, and Operation Stranger was launched as a result of this. One of the things that came out during this operation was that shortly after Mark Tinsley's disappearance, there were a number of reported attempted child abductions in the Workingham area that the police had, for some reason, chosen not to make public. In November of 1985, Hackney police raided an apartment on Kingsmead Estate after receiving a report that a 13-year-old was being abused there. Unfortunately, they did not find the child in question, and later they picked up the informant and went to visit the flat and questioned the occupants, who were Lenny Smith and Robert Oliver. Both of these men had prior convictions for child sexual abuse concerning young boys, and because of this, they questioned them on Jason Swift's murder. Apparently, however, they got nowhere with this. Now, in February of 1986, this same boy that had been reported as being at the apartment in London, the Kingsmead Estates, was found when they raided a house in Croydon while they were making inquiries into Jason's murder. So basically what the police were doing were going to the homes of known sex offenders who had, you know, a history of violence. And in the course of this, they found this boy who had been reported months earlier. While this was going on, they're talking to this boy and, you know, questioning him on what had happened. Police in another town had arrested Leslie Smith when they received a report of a man driving around town attempting to entice young boys into his car. The police found the man and questioned him, and he freely admitted to trying to lure young boys into his vehicle, at which point he was promptly arrested. This was Sidney Cook. It was at this point that the police in this other town learned that both Cook and Smith had been named by the child that the police in Hackney had discovered as having brutally raped him before selling him off. This set off a massive chain of events, which ended with 12 members of this network, the aforementioned Dirty Dozen, being arrested. And they all were eventually convicted, but the ones who really don't play into this story, I'm still throwing their names out there because I think individuals who do this kind of thing are the scum of the earth. One of them was a man by the name of Walter Ballantyne. Another was Leonard William Smith, Simon Hames, Colin Byrne, Daniel Payne, Roy Allen Morris, Alfred Goddard, John Thornton, John Steed, Edward Talbot, and Brian Turner. Now, unfortunately, none of these guys got anywhere near real time for the horrific crimes that they did. One of the men who was snagged in this operation was a man by the name of Leslie Catweasel Bailey. And Bailey admitted to the rape and murder of Mark Swift and Barry Lewis, for which he was sentenced to life in prison. However, once he went into the prison system is where the story really takes a turn, because remember, we're talking about Sidney Cook, and when he was in prison, Bailey was in a cell with another convicted pedophile by the name of Ian Glibb. And this guy, Glibb, went to police and told them that Bailey had begun confessing to him about other murders. This led to the creation of another operation known as Operation Orchard, and this was in 1989. And the reason for this was that Lenny Smith had been heavily implicated in the murder of Jason Swift, and the police suspected there were other members involved in these crimes. Smith, who was under constant surveillance, would eventually be arrested and for abusing a boy in a public toilet and sentenced to 3 years. Back to Ian. I apologize. I mispronounced his last name. I pronounced it Ian Glib. It's Ian Gab. And apparently he was revolted by their crimes, as he did not wish to kill his victims, only abuse them, and he found the fact that they would murder these children to be absolutely abhorrent. These are his own words. And what happened is, first he was in the cell with Bailey, and he sent a letter to the police with a detailed map of where Mark Tildesley had been killed, as well as a letter addressed to Sidney Cook. During this time, they moved Gibb into cells with Oliver and then Cook. And it was at this point that Bailey confessed that he and his ring had in fact killed Mark Tisdale. Now, according to Bailey, on the night that Mark disappeared, he and his lover, Lenny Smith, had driven from Hackney to Workingham, as there would be a quote-unquote party in a caravan owned by Cook located near to the fair. Now, the police were able to determine that Cook was in fact at the fair at this time, as he had been questioned, and the owner of the fair admitted that Cook was one of her employees. According to Bailey, upon arriving at the fair, Smith went to find Cook, and they came back not long after, dragging a young boy with them who was apparently kicking and screaming despite being enticed with a 50-pound bag of sweets. They ended up driving to Cook's caravan, at which point they drugged the boy with milk that had been laced with a muscle relaxant. Afterwards, the four men took turns raping Mark. They took a short break before they poured more of the muscle relaxant directly down Mark's throat and continued with the abuse. Smith then apparently forced a pill down Mark's throat and then grabbed him by the neck. And Bailey referred to this as Mark's party, which shows you the sick depravity of these men. But Bailey also said that he knew Mark was dead at this point, as he was unable to feel a pulse. He was told, apparently, by Cook that Mark was fine and that he would take the boy home, at which point Smith and Bailey left. Neither he nor Smith knew of the whereabouts of Mark Tildesley, although it should be noted that if we are to take this man's word as being the gospel truth, Mark was unfortunately dead long before his parents even realized he was missing. But armed with this evidence, the police proceeded to press murder charges on the other members of the gang besides Bailey, including Sidney Cook. Before I get into what happened, with Sidney Cook and his gang of scumbags, I want to read a letter that Ian Gibb sent to the police after having spent a cell with Sidney Cook. Dear Richard, I moved in with Sidney Cook yesterday afternoon. Please God, don't ever let this man walk our streets again. He continually talks about sex with children. It's really sickening. I can tell you that there are probably 25 to 30 dead children buried out there. Cook has already admitted to me that he's seen about 15 killed. All that I write is the truth. The only part that is missing is the creeping feeling of evil I get while listening to Cook tell me of these events. I cannot relate the fear I feel for children everywhere that I feel while this man Cook laughs and squeals in delight as he tells me is the things he has done and the things he intends to do in the future. Hearing those words, I want to keep you to keep in mind that Ian Gibb was himself a convicted child sex offender. Whether he is being truthful or not in the things he said, or whether he was just trying to work an angle in order to get a more lenient sentence, I don't know. But I do know that other inmates who have had contact with Cook described very similar encounters with him, and that he delighted in the discomfort that his words caused in them. In May of 1990, the police publicly started a search for the bodies of four boys in a car park adjacent to a Clapton synagogue. No bodies were found, however, police later admitted that they found evidence that a body had been there, but that it had been moved to another location. In July of 1990, Scotland Yard disclosed that detectives were investigating the disappearance of boys over a 6 years period, as well as deaths during the making of films in London dating back to 1984. Police pressed forward with the indictments of Cook and other members of his gang. Unfortunately, only Bailey ended up being convicted of the actual murders. Cook and his associates were convicted of the lesser charge of manslaughter. Bailey was also convicted on the 23rd of October for the manslaughter and buggery of Mark Tilsley, who was age 7. He was the first murder that we talked about. Although police did not believe he was the worst of the offenders, as he had some form of diminished capability due to severe learning disabilities and mental disorders. As for the other men, they were initially sentenced to life in prison. However, when Bailey took full responsibility for Jason Swift's murder on himself, they were lessened to 15 years in prison. They appealed their convictions, and with the exception of Bailey, all of the men had sentence reductions, with Cook's being brought down to 16 years. This is despite the fact that Cook did an imitation for police of Swift's death rattle. That is the noise the child made as he died, and apparently he enjoyed this greatly when doing it, as well as indicating that he knows where Mark's body is buried, but refusing to tell them where it is. Now, Bailey was murdered while he was in prison, thankfully. Of the men who were convicted of manslaughter in the Swift case, the only one I could find anything on besides Sidney Cook was Robert Oliver, who had been given 15 years. He was released after 8 years and changed his name apparently to Carl Curtis. He was rearrested and jailed for 3 years after being found guilty of luring children into his home, in Maidstone, Kent. Now, Cook was released in April of 1998. And one of the things that he told the parole board was that Bailey, who by this point was dead, had in fact been the ringleader of the gang, and that he had more or less just gone along with it. Cook's parole caused a massive outcry in Britain. I'm talking, like, to the levels of if they had attempted to parole Charles Manson here in the U.S., people were beyond angry and disgusted over this turn in his case. More so after it was learned that the area they proposed to parole him to was within walking distance of two schools. Now, Cook admitted to the parole officers and everyone else that there was a very good chance that he would reoffend if paroled. However, Britain's prison system being what it is, they pretty much hold cases or prison terms to what they are. Meaning that this piece of crap spent 8 years in prison before being released. Such was the fear of the public's reaction to Cook being released. The police actually smuggled him out of prison under cover of darkness, refusing to state where they had brought Cook. As it turns out, he ended up spending 10 months living in a suite of jail cells at the Yeovil police station, and this was of his own request because Cook stated he feared for the safety of his life, which he reasonably should have feared for the safety of his life. My personal opinion, a little bit of rant, but Sidney Cook and other individuals like this, 90 days to appeal anywhere in the world, I don't care where, after which you're executed, because crimes like this, whether the victim lives or dies, the victims can't fully grasp what it is that they are partaking of or what is being forced upon them, but it's also something that they carry with them for the rest of their lives. Again, this is not something that is done to a child and, you know, they forget about it after the fact. The child will feel the effects of this abuse the rest of their life, and it is unlike any other crime in the world that I'm aware of, in that the victim continues to suffer years, decades after the crime has been committed. The good news, however, is that the Channel 4 documentary program Dispatches did a program on Sidney Cook, snippets of which you heard at the beginning of this show. And because of the public interest in this show and the amount of tips that the police received, they opened up another investigation into Sidney Cook, looking for anything that they could find to put the man back behind bars. On January 26, 1999, Sidney Cook was rearrested, and he was charged at the Reading Police Station with committing 18 offenses between 1972 and 1981 in Battersea and Stockwell in South London, Twyford, Berks, Canterbury, Kent, Washington, Tyne, and Ware, Hatfield, Berkhamsted, and Tringenhurst. He was moved back to prison on remand, which basically means he was being held until his court date. A couple of these assaults included repeated abuse of two brothers in the 1970s, and apparently the rape of a young woman, which, given his predisposition for young boys, I find actually pretty hard to believe, but okay. On October 5th, 1999, Sidney Cook pled guilty to sexually abusing the two brothers on 10 occasions in 1972 and 1973. He admitted to having carried out 5 counts of indecent assault and 5 counts of buggery committed between 1972 and 1978. However, he denied the other charges, which were 4 counts of rape, 3 further counts of indecent assault, and 1 of buggery that occurred in 1981. The judge decided to abandon these charges, instead deciding that they would lie on file, which meant that should Sidney Cook for some reason ever come up for parole again, he could be charged with them. Later, NSPCC, which is basically the prosecutor for the Queen's Court, said the children who were abused by Sidney Cook suffered some of the vilest, cruelest sex offenses imaginable. He should never have been freed after serving his last sentence. We sincerely hope he will never be given the opportunity to hurt another child again. And the only thing I can think after reading that is, no shit, he should never have been released. Yes, he lived in a police station for 10 months, but he would on occasion go out into public, and there is no telling what form of depravity he may or may not have gotten up to while he was out. What is known about Sidney Cook while he is in prison is that he has formed a bond with another convicted child molester, such to the point that they are quoted as being inseparable. Unfortunately, to the best of my knowledge from everything I've read, and it's been quite a bit on this sick piece of garbage, none of the other victims of Sidney Cook are currently known. His murder victims. Nor are any other perpetrators for these crimes known, although I suspect that the other men who were arrested as part of his Dirty Dozen probably had a hand in this. I also suspect that Sidney Cook probably murdered a lot more children that we know nothing about, seeing as he had such indifference to the murder of the boys for which he was convicted. And he literally saw them as nothing more than objects for he and his friends' own amusement. A lot of things say that he's suspected in at least 9. I would probably say, just based on what I've read, that the number is probably into the 30s. Again, his one cellmate said that he had confessed to him to having killed at least 25 to 30 children, and this is probably the truth of the matter. Currently, Cook, who is in his 90s, I believe, is at Wakefield Prison in Wakefield, West Yorkshire, London, which is pretty much a prison for high-risk, high-profile sex offenders. He's in there with people like that scumfuck Ian Watkins, who was the lead singer for the band Lost Prophets, Mark Bridger, Jack Renshaw. He's pretty much in there with a who's who of scum. And this is one of those times where I wish, we had a prisoner exchange program between Britain and America, because I think individuals like that, they're not going to execute them. Send them to American prisons and let what they did be known to the other prisoners and, see what happens. That is it for the Deathcast this week. I know this was kind of a strange, disjointed story this week, but the culprit in question is a strange and disjointed individual. His story is very hard to follow, and unfortunately, unlike in the U.S., it is very difficult to find out certain aspects of cases with people in Britain. More so if, you know, it involves children and murder. A perfect example of that is the murder of James Bulger, who was killed by, I think they were 10 years old boys, back in the early 90s, and upon being released from prison, the country of Britain decided, oh, we're just gonna change these boys' names, and if you ever release the names that they're going under, we're gonna jail you. So that's the kind of stuff I was up against as far as this case goes. Hope you gleaned maybe some information from this story that, you know, things like child sex trafficking rings actually do exist, despite the narrative that we're being fed over recent years that they are not there. That's not the case. Sydney Cook is a prime example of one. Another one would be North Fox Island in Michigan, where a millionaire named Francis Sheldon trafficked boys across the country for Lord knows how long, until being discovered in the 1970s, at which point he fled the country. And Sheldon, as I mentioned on the episode covering the Houston mass murders, had ties to both John Wayne Gacy and Dean Corll. So these things do exist, unfortunately. Till next week, I am your host, Ian Totten. Be safe and stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deadcast.